Welcome to the Interesting Football Podcast. My name's Laurie Knox, and this week we'll be investigating whether Crystal Palace are the most interesting team in the Premier League. As always, I'm joined by former Horling resident Simon Day. Mr. Day, how are you, and what are your first thoughts when you hear the name Crystal Palace?
I'm very good. I'm really looking forward to this. We've got some great facts about Crystal Palace tonight. But when I think of Crystal Palace, I think of my two terrible visits to Selhurst Park. The first one being New Year's Day in the year, I think, 2001, possibly 2002, when I turned up at Selhurst Park on New Year's Day at about 12 o'clock for a lunchtime kickoff. No idea what was a lunchtime kickoff. Only to discover the game had just been called off for a frozen pitch about half an hour before kickoff, which wasn't the best way to start the new year, to be honest with you. And secondly, I went to Selhurst Park about 3 years later, and the game took place this time, and Crystal Palace had a player sent off. Gillingham missed two penalties, and Crystal Palace won 1-0. It was, you know, when people say something's a bit Spursy, that was a bit Jillsy. To be honest.
Right. That's something for the old football I Spy. You know, we've always spoken about that in the past, right? About the I Spy books you used to get when you were younger, you know, like on a train journey or whatever, you know, you get 5 points if you see another train, or and then it goes up to like 10 points going through a tunnel, and then 50 points if it's something really unusual, like a steam engine or whatever. I think, you know, we've spoken about that in the past, about football I Spy. Going to a game that's called off, that's one I don't think I've got. I don't think I've ever had that.
Oh, I did it twice. I did it Jill's once. Turned up at the, well, me and my friends parked up at the game about half an hour before kickoff, only to see loads of people walking away from the stadium. and it transpired that it had just been called off for a waterlogged pitch. Ouch. Or something. Yeah, the wounder.
Ouch. Well, for me, with Crystal Palace, my two of my best friends when I was younger were Palace fans. And, you know, growing up in the Isle of Sheppey, where, you know, everybody who liked football probably supported in the 80s, Liverpool, Manchester United and Arsenal. And so we kind of like stuck out like sore thumbs, Crystal Palace and Sheffield Wednesday fans. And also, yeah, my James, who was in my class, yeah, we were probably the two most hardcore football fans as well. So, you know, I always think of those guys. And, you know, I have to mention the FA Cup semi-final of 1991 when they beat Liverpool 4-3 in what's probably the greatest FA Cup semi-final of all time, right? Especially when it's a very unfancy team playing one of the best in the world.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Liverpool were champions that year, weren't they, I think? And did Alan Pardew scored the winner, didn't he?
Oh, he definitely scored. I'd be lying if I said it was quite possibly.
I'm sure we scored the winner, Alan Pardew. Whatever happened to him?
So, Mr. Day, what's the first fact for Crystal Palace?
Right, we're going in big with this one. We're going in big. Fact number one. Both Colonel Gaddafi and P. Diddy have been linked with buying Crystal Palace in the past.
Wow.
Now, who do you want me to tackle first on this one? Gaddafi or Diddy?
Well, you know, my love of Osama bin Laden within the football arena only, I would like to point out. So I'm going to have to hear some more about Mr. Gaddafi, or General Gaddafi. Sorry, that was disrespectful of me.
Oh, is he General now? I thought it was Colonel Gaddafi. Did he get upgraded?
Oh, Colonel. Sorry. My bad.
Oh, man. Right. Unfortunately, this is the slightly more tenuous one. We're veering into Doug Ellis invented the overhead kick territory here. But basically, Simon Jordan has said in interview multiple times that before he was Palace owner, he'd heard that Colonel Gaddafi was interested in buying the club. This was around 2004. Now, at the time, weirdly, Gaddafi owned 5% of Juventus.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. Now, unfortunately, Colonel Gaddafi hasn't really spoken out about his interest in buying Crystal Palace. But more excitingly, P. Diddy was a genuine, almost bought the club because he really liked the name Crystal Palace. And he had meetings with agents.
Name, especially for a rapper.
Well, I sort of thought that. When you think about it, have Crystal Palace got the best name, of the coolest name of any football league club?
I mean, it needs to be something in unique, individual. So I'm going to throw Aston Villa in there as well, which is quite a nice sounding one as well.
Yeah, but a Palace is better than a Villa, isn't it? Especially if it's made of crystal.
This is true. This is true.
This is true. I've been to Aston. Anyway, he had meetings with people in London about it because he wanted to buy a club, and he homed in on Crystal Palace because he really liked the name. But it never transpired. At the time, this was 2010. At the time, Palace were like languishing in the lower reaches of the Championship, so it wasn't like a glamour purchase. He just liked the name.
So how about some more club owners, the most bizarre club owners that we've had then? I suppose Newcastle are probably in with a shout there. I know Sheffield United are partly funded by the Bin Laden family, but any others? I think they loaned them money. I mean, to be fair, you know, Osama was just a bit of a bad apple. You know, I think the rest of the family.
But he always gets a mention, doesn't he? He always gets a mention.
I suppose he's always going to. But
when I heard about Gaddafi and Didi, I just immediately thought of them doing like when Michael Knighton almost bought Man U and was doing keep ups in his Man U kit on the pitch. Oh, I would have loved to have seen Gaddafi or even Didi doing a bit of that. That'd have been superb.
I'd see them both actually doing like head tennis or header tennis or something like that.
Yeah, playing. I was thinking of done a consortium of Gaddafi and Didi.
But going back to weird club owners, I don't know if he was an owner, but the chairman, Sheffield United's ex-chairman, was called Dick Rag, which I think is worthy of mention.
Spelt with a W at the front.
Yes, of rag. Indeed.
Yes, of rag, not of dick.
Dick rag,
yeah.
Yes.
Dick rag. Like, probably the go-to celebrity when you talk about people in the higher echelons of football clubs is still Delia Smith, isn't it, I think? That's like the first name that pops into my head. Because she's been at Norwich for like absolute like decades, hasn't she? A
couple of decades,
the whole sort of Lexby Avenue thing was like 15 years ago, I think, wasn't it?
Indeed, yeah. I suppose you've got to give a shout out to Wrexham as well, Ryan Reynolds and the other guy whose name I can never remember.
They all say he's an actor, don't they? They all say he's an actor and he's a comedian, yeah, but I've never heard of him.
I mean, that just came out of nowhere, didn't it? But there we go. Wrexham, I've been there once for an early kickoff as well. Good times.
Good time up the Wrexham.
Enjoyed the stadium.
It was indeed. I once saw Gillingham fail to get promoted at Wrexham, and it was utterly miserable. We needed a draw to go up, and we needed a draw to go up, and lost 1-0 to like a 35-yard screamer. Utterly miserable. Talking to celebrity owners. My favourite television programme at the moment is Succession, which is about like it's a Rupert Murdoch parody, and it's about the uber rich. And in it, one of the kids. He's played by Macaulay Culkin's brother. For his dad's birthday, his dad being the Rupert Murdoch character. And I apologize if I get the teams mixed up here, but basically, his dad's Scottish, and he remembers as a kid that his dad was a massive Hibs fan, so he buys him Hibs for his birthday. But it then transpires he actually supported Hearts. so the kid's basically just. He's bought Hibs for like, and he's got no interest in the matter whatsoever. And I do kind of think, like, these sort of ridiculously rich people, is that how it works? Is it just like a little plaything and you've got no interest in the matter whatsoever? I think that might be a bit close to the bone.
I would love it if you bought Sheffield United for me. I'd be straight on the phone to Peter Reid. Look, Peter, we've got another job for you, mate.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
There we go.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
Could I get them to the conference within 3 years? That'd be a fantastic little project.
Would you rather own the club you support or their biggest rivals? I don't know.
Realistically, what am I going to do in charge of Sheffield Wednesday? Am I going to have that much of an impact in Sheffield Wednesday's history? No, but I definitely think I could get Sheffield United into the conference within half a decade. But something to dream about.
Yeah,
there's a couple of damn good facts there. Gaddafi, possibly, and P. Diddy definitely were in the running to take over Crystal Palace. And that takes us on to the quiz. It's a tough one this week. But we've done it with the par. We've sorted you out of the par. You're going to have a par of six today.
Mm-hmm.
And here we go. 15 players have played for England whilst at Crystal Palace. And that includes loan players. There's a bit of a clue for you.
They've been on loan at Crystal Palace. Or the Crystal Palace.
They've been on loan at Crystal Palace, yes.
Oh, God. Oh,
okay. And so 15 of them. I will say 11 of the... Is that 11? No, 10 of them have been from 1991 onwards. So there's a bit of a clue there. You need to get 6 of them in 1 minute. Your time starts now.
Wilfried Zaha.
Yes, one cap.
John Solarco. That bloke called, was it Andy Gray? Well, not the Andy Gray.
There
was
well done. Yes, midfielder. Andy Gray, 3, yes.
He got 3 caps?
No. Sorry. You're number 3. He got 1 cap.
Did Ian Wright get capped while he was at Palace?
He did. 4 caps at Palace.
Nigel Martin.
Oh, we're on 5 with 30 seconds left.
Oh, yeah, but it's going a bit to shit now, isn't it? I can't think I'm going to go. Andros Townsend?
Oh, you've got par. You're on 6.
Oh, right, okay. My life.
25 seconds to get one more.
Oh, no. I can't think of any current players. Surely can't be any current players.
I'm going to be kind and say there's a current loanee.
Someone who's on loan at Palace?
Yes. 10 seconds.
Oh, man. He wasn't. Nathaniel Clyne, was he at Palace when he got capped?
Nathaniel Clyne, that's your last answer. And you're at... No, it was not him. So in order from 1914 onwards, we've got the famous Horace Colclough, Jack Anderson, Johnny Byrne. The fourth one from 1976, Peter Taylor.
Ah, now Peter Taylor almost turned up in this pod actually, because I'm sure he got capped when Palace were like in the third tier or something.
Ridiculous. Oh, and you forgot about him now.
And he was the first ever son. He was the first ever footballer to be the son paid 7 fella.
Oh, yes. Oh, that would have been a great fact. Great fact. I'm disappointed that one didn't make it. Kenny Sansom was number 5, their joint top most capped with 9. Then Ian Wright, then their other joint top, Jeff Thomas.
Oh, Jeff Thomas.
John Solarco, Andy Gray, Nigel Martin, Andy Johnson, Wilfried Zaha, Andros Townsend. And the last two were Ruben Loftus-Cheek.
Oh, yeah.
And the current loanee you missed out on, Conor Gallagher.
Oh, which was last week, wasn't it? He played against...
But there we go. But still, that was a tough question and you got par. So congratulations for that. You're still winning 3-2 in the quiz. Why don't you hit us with fact number 2?
Fact number 2, Conor Gallagher may crop up in fact number 2. Because fact number 2 is Crystal Palace's Martin Kelly has the shortest ever England career. He has an England career of 2 minutes and 39 seconds.
Did he touch the ball at least?
It's a bit hard to find out. I think he did touch the ball. It was in a friendly before against Norway before Euro 2012. And to Martin Kelly's credit, despite the fact he's only ever played 2 minutes for England, he actually went to a major tournament.
Oh, which tournament?
2012. He got called up because of an injury, played in one of the last warm-up matches, and they kept him in the squad for the tournament.
Okay. So,
but apparently he had a virus for most of the tournament and was never actually in contention to play.
Well, at least that's an experience. He got to go. He got a free holiday out of it, right?
Well, he did. It's a funny free holiday to the Ukraine.
whilst they're suffering from a virus.
Yeah, it's what dreams are made of. It's a funny career, Martin Kelly, because he's still in his prime in footballing terms. But he's been at Palace for a few years now. Last season, he made one appearance. And this season, he's just playing for like the under-23s, which is like the equivalent of the reserves. So he's kind of... big things were expected of him at Liverpool, but it never really transpired. But he got to go to a tournament.
And we should point out for anyone who's listening to this and thinking, why wasn't he mentioned in the quiz? He was playing for Liverpool at the time of his 2 minutes of fame.
Yeah, and he played 1 second less than Nathaniel Chalabar, who played 2 minutes and 40 seconds a couple of years ago for England.
I love that there's only a second in it. That's fantastic.
Well done. Also, look at other players that have got a really short amount of England career under their belts. Joey Barton has played 11 minutes for England.
Is that right?
Yeah, Chris Sutton only played 12 minutes for England, which really surprised me.
That surprises me too.
I had him down as like a nine cap man, I think, Chris Sutton. Jack Cork has played 4 minutes for England.
Who?
Matt Jarvis, I only thrown him in because he used to play for Gillingham, has played 21 minutes for England. But my favourite, very short England career, is David Nugent, who, whilst at Preston, played 11 minutes for England and scored my favourite ever England goal during that 11 minutes.
Yeah.
Where someone had a shot, the keeper half saved it, the ball was trickling in, and David Nugent, this was in Andorra, so it was like the 24th goal of a 24-0 win or something. The ball was trickling in, and David Nugent absolutely bust a gut to get to the ball as it literally was on the line, and then blasted it home as if it was like a 30-yarder and whirled away in celebration.
In fact, former Sheffield Wednesday terrible striker, the Fox in the Box, also has one cap and one goal.
Oh, and Franny Jeffers. And for a point, who else made his debut in that game?
Against Australia, 2003.
Park.
No idea.
Wayne Rooney.
Is that right? Wow, yeah. Rooney and Jeffers, those careers, beards.
I love
beards, didn't they? Somewhat.
Ericsson at the start of the game. This is going to be my strike partnership going forward.
Rooney, yeah, and you know there have been all those like newspapers like predicting, okay, this is going to be the World Cup squad in 10 years' time. Yeah, Franny Jeffers up front, yeah. Rooney on the bench.
It's always funny when you see those. But you sometimes see it on Instagram, don't you? It's like, this is what the England World Cup squad for 2020 looked like when people predicted it in 2010 or whatever. And it's just full of people you've never heard of, isn't it?
Indeed. Right.
I can remember in the 90s, Chris Bart-Williams was always in like, this would be the England squad going to like 1998 World Cup. Like 5 years' time, and people like Chris Bart-Williams would always be in it, wouldn't they? And like, yeah, it's not.
Yeah, Bart-Williams, that was a weird one. So he joined Wednesday when we were really good at the age of 17. So he's kind of like, you know, a squad player, but he's getting quite a bit of game time. So it's like, yeah, this guy is going to be doing things. I think he just, when he jumped ship at the right moment when Wednesday were turning bad. But then he moved to Forest, another club that were kind of on their way down. And it's definitely the wrong move at the wrong time. But there we go.
So do you think, taking into account the likes of Martin Kelly and David Nugent and Conor Gallagher, who's cropped up, are caps devalued now?
I don't think so, because I think, you know, if you are those guys, I'm sure David Nugent is so proud of that one cap and that one goal. I'm sure they all are incredibly proud, right? I mean, maybe if you're looking at the devaluation, you know, if you took, talk about like David Beckham, the 120 caps, you know, like maybe it means nothing to him, but I think that first cap is still incredible. You know, to most people, they see it as the pinnacle. So no, I think from a player's point of view, no, it's not devalued at all.
So to take it a step further then, are international goals devalued? And I say this as Harry Kane comes off the back of scoring like 5 goals against San Marino and Albania to put him level with Gary Lineker, just because back in the day, you didn't have as many games against absolute dross, did you?
No, I mean, yeah, I think that's probably a fairer argument, right? I mean, yeah, you know, if you play a couple of caps against San Marino, you're still going to be pretty proud. But yeah, it's clearly a lot easier. If you look at the top goal scorers, right, how many of them have been in the last 10, 20 years? A few, yeah, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's just easy to score goals, isn't it? And don't get me wrong, people like Lineker, I'm sure Bobby Charlton scored a few goals against some dross. But yeah, it just seems, it's the same in cricket as well, to be fair. It's just, you get more easy outings now, don't you, to pad the stats a bit. And
right.
I do think it sort of devalues international goals when Harry Kane can like net 4 against San Marino or whatever.
Yeah, if you look at the fact that in England's World Cup group, Andorra aren't even bottom. I mean, it's just... I mean, say Albania, to be fair, England's win against... You know, Albania have done pretty well. They're, you know, they're a much better team than they were, you know, in the 80s.
Yes.
They're one of those teams you'd expect to win 8. No, I think that was a good win for England. Albania aren't a terrible side. But, you know, to have Andorra and San Marino in the same group...
How are they in different pots in qualifying?
Yes.
How'd that happen?
So, I mean, in Asia, they go through two or three stages. I know they've got two group stages. And there might even be a qualifier for the,
yes,
for the group. I mean, I think they do need something like that in Europe because, you know, yeah, I mean, is it really worthwhile players leaving their clubs for a week or two to play against San Marino? I don't think it is.
No, but, and also I think San Marino would get more out of playing Gibraltar and Luxembourg, wouldn't they? And if they had like a group between them, they'd all have a chance to win a couple of games. And we're sounds a bit patronising, but...
We're not talking about making it impossible. So for a country, you know, again, you put it on based on their rank, their world rankings. You know, so for a country like Albania, who maybe would have been in the pre-qualifiers in the 80s, you know, they wouldn't be now, would they? You know, so it's...
No, they got to a tournament, didn't they? Well, the best example of that is Turkey. So in the 80s, Turkey were always the team that like England would absolutely trounce, wouldn't they?
They beat them 8-0, I think, twice, didn't they?
Yeah, they were like the San Marino of their day, essentially, weren't they?
Right.
But now, in this century, they've got to two major semi-finals.
Indeed, yeah.
So clearly you can progress. And you wouldn't have said... I mean, look at like a country the size and age of Croatia, for them to get to a World Cup final in such a relatively short space of time is pretty amazing, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So, yeah, you can sort of... It needs to be an open shop, but I just feel like teams like San Marino, Andorra, etc. would benefit from playing each other a bit more.
Right, yeah, indeed.
So, final point on this. The San Marino team, it's always a staple of what tabloid newspapers do when there's a crap team in international football. They put the San Marino team on the page with all of their jobs on it. And like of the 11 starters for San Marino, there was one whose job was professional footballer.
And he was the right back.
He was certainly defending.
He was the right back because I thought of the same thing with Scotland. You know, like Scotland's probably one world-class player who you think would get into most international teams is also their right back. I was thinking, like, literally, if you say your country can have one world-class player, what position would it be? I think fullback would be the last position you would pick, right? But
that or goalkeeper, I think.
Oh, I think I'd rather have a goalkeeper. Yeah, I think goalkeeper would be a bit higher up than fullback, certainly. But
so do you think the San Marino right back was the one to watch in the previews of the game?
Possibly.
Or star man.
The one who's like still to be running after 70 minutes.
Well, one of them, their job was student.
Oh, really? Nice.
Yeah, which is like, that's it for.
So,
they might have a job, not working a call centre or something. They could have put something up, couldn't they?
Let's move on to our bizarre fans. So for this week, I mean, we had a few good ones. We had Liam Neeson's been rumoured to support Palace. I think he's just attended a game, though, so I didn't count him. I want a proper supporter. There was that bear, Roger De Courcy's bear. What was the bear's name?
Nookie.
I almost said Pokey then. I'm glad you jumped in front of me. But I'm going to go for the one and only Nigel Farage.
Who looks a bit like he could be a ventriloquist doll, doesn't he?
Not a bad point.
You could see him sitting on, not necessarily Roger De Courcy, but you could see him sitting on someone's knee, couldn't you? With that weird face of his.
But Farage, he was on LBC in 2017 saying that, yeah, he and his family were Palace fans. His son's got a season ticket. He tweeted after Palace lost the cup final to Man U, commiserations to Palace. I don't think he's a hardcore fan, but he does, you know, a family member's got a season ticket. He has been consistent over the years about being a Palace fan. He's from that area. So, you know what? I'm going to stick with Nigel Farage as our bizarre fan.
No, that's eligible. I think you've outlined enough credentials to make him a legit fan, which I'm sure Crystal Palace are really proud of.
But does he count as bizarre? I mean, he's just a bizarre human.
It is pretty bizarre.
Human,
no,
he?
I think it's pretty bizarre. Well, he's a bizarre human, but I think on the face of it, I wouldn't expect Nigel Farage to be a football fan.
Yeah. Also, I suppose because Crystal Palace is such a, you know, it's in such a racially diverse area, that also is surprising that Nigel Farage approves.
Do you think Nigel Farage? This is me being really cynical. Do you think Nigel Farage is legit in that? Do you think his political views are his genuine political views, or he just knows that there's something to tap into there.
Do you think he's half doing a Boris?
Yeah.
I think Boris Johnson was just flat out opportunist. I mean, but it's the kind of thing, maybe it's like the dog wagging the tail kind of thing. Like maybe it started off like, oh, I got a bit of attention when I said that. And then and then it just goes on where it just becomes this thing where whether he believed it at the start, I don't know, but I'm sure he's full on into that. I think he's legit in the sense that he believes what he says.
Have you seen Farage is obviously on this GB News nonsense, and he's got I don't know if it's nightly, but he's got a regular program on there called, it's called something like A Pint with Nigel, where like they will sit in the studio with a pint of presumably stale, lukewarm beer and pretend to sup on it whilst discussing the political points of the day, presumably immigrants turning up on the beach. And it will always be like a political pundit. But this week, Nigel Farage tweeted out, join me at 8 o'clock for a pint with Farage with Kerry Katona.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't watch it, but I'm sure it was hot political chat. To be honest,
that's probably one of the few celebrities you could tell me about that I'd actually be quite interested in, because, you know, talk about bizarre fans. I mean, that's a bizarre pairing. Nigel Farage and Kerry Katona having a pint discussing politics. I mean, could we have Dean Gaffney and Osama bin Laden talking, you know, like hosting fantasy football or something like that?
This is where how we need to get these celebrity fans together, the ones that are alive. Fantasy football was like the sort of the epicenter where celebrity fans would sort of have a forum, wouldn't they? As celebrities who supported a football club,
right?
Because that had a really weird mix, didn't it? Of like proper big names on it, and like Roger De Courcy and Nicky Bear. It was
and Tango.
Like, yeah, the Tango Man, stuff like that. But I'm trying to think. There were a couple of like proper like big A-listers on there as well. Sometimes I think.
Was it Kate Moss? There was definitely a supermodel on there, because I remember her making fun of Kevin Pressman. So she had him go for her fantasy football team. She's like, oh, yeah, but I couldn't imagine him on a thong in a beach. Was her worst about Kevin Pressman, which to be fair, I couldn't either. But
I can remember Joe Lydon turning up pissed for one episode. But yeah, they did have some big names on there. I'd quite happily watch some kind of chat show with Dean Gaffney and Nigel Farage talking about football. I'd be well up for that. I'm not sure Ketley and Fish would sort of, I'm not sure that's very interesting, but.
No. But Farage, okay, so I think we've got a decent lineup right now. I think Chelsea, who knows, they could have a short run of the lineal title. Let's see. Let's hit this with fact number three.
You're all down to this. Fact number three is Crystal Palace have only been known as the Eagles since 1972. Before that, they were known as the Glaziers and sometimes the Crystals.
Wow.
Now, I've never thought about this before. Football teams changing nicknames and why. So you wouldn't in a million years guess why Crystal Palace changed their nickname to the Eagles. Because the answer is... No, go on, have a wild stab in the dark. Why did they change their name to the Eagles?
Because I know Malcolm Allison was involved in changing their colours.
Yes.
So I'm guessing Allison was... Yeah, the 70s, weren't they? The team of the decade. They were done.
Yes.
That's as far as I'm going to get without just making a really wild guess.
Well, yeah, he changed their kit to... Because it used to be claret and blue. He changed it to a more sort of red and blue because he wanted them to resemble Barcelona. But he also didn't like the name the Glaziers, so he wanted them to sound more aggressive. And he appeared to just pluck out of thin air the Eagles. But such was his influence that by the next year, they'd actually changed their club badge to have an eagle on it.
Damn.
Now, I think staggered's probably taken it a bit far, but I took a step back when I read this because I just love the idea of someone coming in as manager and just going, I want to change the kit, I want to change the nickname. I mean, could you imagine if Sheffield Wednesday got a new manager who just said, why are you called the Owls? That's rubbish. Wouldn't we sound a bit more aggressive? What about like the Falcons or something?
Yeah, I could not imagine that happening. But yeah.
And also, blue and white. No good teams playing blue and white. What about blue and black, like Inter Milan? Let's go for that.
Yeah, which makes me question whether the Crystal Palace, how hardcore the Palace fans were back then, because, you know, I can't imagine, you know, look at what happened when Cardiff changed colours. The fans absolutely hated it, didn't they? I mean, yeah, wow. Why didn't the Palace fans kick up a fuss?
Well, maybe they did.
Maybe they did. This is true.
Maybe they did. But I think ultimately it boils down to success, doesn't it? Because I know Gillingham a few years ago, they sort of changed their kit to a red and blue rather than just blue. And right. I'm sure there'd have been more uproar about it if it weren't for the fact we won the league that season.
Right.
That kind of quashes any kind of discontent, I think, doesn't it? Being any good.
A very interesting question, I think, which you actually posed me once many, many years ago, which I occasionally whip out, is like, when does your football team stop being your football team? Which kind of goes on to that. Yeah. So, for example, if Sheffield Wednesday changed their name to Sheffield City, I'd clearly still support them. They change their kit from blue to green, I'd still support them. If they moved from Hillsborough to, I don't know, the Greyhound Stadium down the road, I'd still support. But, you know, if they did all of those at the same time, would you still support them? Is that still your tip? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you're one step away from MK Dons there, aren't you? to take it on a more sort of real level, certainly personally, and for a lot of Gillingham supporters at the moment, does it matter who the owner is or who the manager is? In the, if, say, let's take this to an extreme. If he was still alive, Colonel Gaddafi took over as Sheffield Wednesday owner, would you still support Sheffield Wednesday?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the owners matter that. I'll tell you one thing that's made a big difference to my Sheffield Wednesday supportingness is the fact that, you know, from when we got relegated and turned really bad for about 15 years, yeah, I'd still go to games and still support them. But there was this weird thing where it was constantly every year the team would change, some new free transfers were brought in.
Tell me about it. Yeah.
Whereas since about 2015, it seems like we've had a core of a squad that kind of gets updated, you know, like, and even though we've gone back down to League One, I still feel kind of like more attached to the team than say 10 years ago, because, you know, it's that same core of players. And it just changes slowly over time, which, you know, again, gives you, for me, it makes it more like a team you support rather than just a random bunch of a ragtag army that's been put together for a game.
Okay, then. But if this ragtag band, for example, or the manager was someone, let's say Sheffield Wednesday signed someone like Ched Evans, who I know there's quite a few Preston supporters who stopped going to watch Preston, didn't they, when they signed Ched Evans?
Is that right?
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I'm sure there's plenty of other football. I can't think of it off the top of my head. If Andy Johnson came out of prison and Sheffield Wednesday signed him. Was it Andy Johnson? No,
Adam Johnson.
Adam Johnson. Apologies to ex-Crystal Palace and England cap, Andy Johnson. He just used to dive for penalties, didn't he? Yes. Nowhere near as serious as what Adam Johnson did. But if he came out of prison and signed for Sheffield Wednesday, would you sort of still be able to get behind the team or cheer when he scored a goal?
I think, no, I would. I'd still clearly go to games. I'd still clearly support the team. I mean, I'd definitely be dead against that. It's
tricky, isn't it?
It is a tough one. It is a tough one indeed.
Or they made him probably to take it to an extreme then, that he became manager.
Yeah, I mean, that would be tough. I'd probably still go to occasional games. I'd probably protest. That's what I'd do. I'd go to a Wednesday protest for the first time.
Yeah, I think you'd find it really hard and I to sort of stay connected with the club and sort of feel
right
at one with them, so to speak, wouldn't you?
Indeed.
But on a lower tone, I personally, if Gillingham's next manager decided, the Gills is a bit rubbish, we want to be called like the Stallions or something because we've got a horse on the logo, then I'd be like, yeah, all right, we'll go with that.
I remember when Wednesday were taken over by Mr. Chancery, our current chairman. I did a bit of, you know, it's the family that owns John West Tuna, Thai family, and so I did a bit of research into the family and their dealings. And New York Times did an article a few years earlier where, it turned out that they were basically sourcing tuna from companies that used slave labor, like literally kidnapping people, sticking them on a boat and like, right, you're fishing for tuna now. And I put this, you know, like everyone was like, oh, this is great. We've got a rich chairman, et cetera. I put this on one of the Wednesday Facebook groups, like, you know, what do we all think about this? Like, I didn't even put an opinion in there. And I just got so much abuse. But this guy's a blade, like trying to, you know, like trying to piss in our parade kind of things. Like, no, just like, what do you guys think about this? You know, like, we're being funded partially by slave labor. You know, does it not have any, you know, does it not feel bad about this? But no, for it appeared nobody did.
Well, I suspect if Newcastle's new owners were who they were, but they weren't investing anywhere near as much money into it, I think Newcastle fans might be a bit more up in arms about it.
But right. I think
because the money is like some like bottomless pit of cash, then they're willing to sort of turn a blind eye to it.
Yeah, and I think that's probably gives you the answer to how most people would feel. Look at Newcastle fans, like 95% of them are massively in favour of it.
Yeah. Exactly. Whereas if they were coming in to own the club, but without the bottomless pit of cash, I think there'd be a lot more people against it, wouldn't there?
But it's weird with financial fair play. How does that work? Because, you know, a lot of Wednesday fans were very excited when Chancery took over because he was willing to throw tens of millions at the club, which he did. But then that led to not doing the accounts properly, which led to a 6-point deduction. That point deduction got us relegated. Yes. Basically been a complete disaster. But, you know, Manchester City, clubs like Manchester City, financial fair play doesn't seem to matter. They can just do whatever they want.
Yeah. It's like society, isn't it? It affects like the smaller, poorer people a lot more than the big lads, doesn't it? I mean, look at the European Super League last year. What have been the ramifications of that?
Right.
Absolutely nothing.
No. What was it when they said like a £2 million fine between all the teams or something like that? It's like, oh my word, that's one of the most pathetic things. Interesting that people are saying, oh, Paris Saint-Germain, what a great, you know, not getting involved, what a great club. But obviously, no, it's just they're owned by Qatar. Qatar's got the next World Cup. They don't want to annoy FIFA.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's all that. But there we go. So, Mr. Day, what do we think? Most interesting club. Chelsea have got the lineal title. A Palace knocking them off the perch?
Yes.
I think so too. I think it's been some good factor. And I'm disappointed, I'll be honest. I feel like we need to mention Peter Taylor being the Sun's first ever Page 7 fella or whatever it's called.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I feel a bit sorry for young Gillingham. There's like a generation of young Gillingham supporters who sort of regard Peter Taylor as being this really boring manager because we had a couple of boring seasons of Peter Taylor about 6 years ago. But the reality is he was manager for the greatest season in the club's history. And a lot of our success was down to him. And I feel like he gets probably, if you ask a Gillingham fan about Peter Taylor, a young Gillingham fan, they'd say he was a bit crap, but actually he masterminded the greatest season in the club's history. I quite happily would have talked about Peter Taylor for a bit.
And his hairy chest.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about his Page 7 appearance, to be honest. I reckon Kevin Keegan appeared on there at some point, I reckon.
Yeah, he seems like the kind of guy who would. And in terms of saying like you don't know much about his Page 7 appearance, I think that's pretty much all there is to know, wasn't there? Like Peter Taylor got his breasts out, appeared on Page 7 of The Sun.
It's not my current screensaver. But do we know? See, I can't remember the Page 7 fella being a thing when I was. I mean, I'm not a Sun reader, but clearly I have seen The Sun quite a few times. I can't remember ever seeing the Page 3 fella, the Page 3 girls were still doing the rounds.
I thought the Page, I could be completely wrong. I thought it was just something like they got out whenever, I don't know, whenever there was someone to do. I didn't think it was a regular thing, whereas Page 3 was a daily thing. I think it's just whenever. I could be wrong if there are any Sun readers out there. Like Paul Eddy or James McQueen, you could maybe tell us, Page 7, was that? I don't think it was a daily thing, but.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think this was always the case, but I did like in the latter days of Page 3, they changed the text box on Page 3. It used to be just like, this is like Stephanie, 25 from Bolton. She likes chips or something. And then they changed it to, The Page Three girl making a really in-depth political comment.
Nice.
Any
examples?
Well, no, because I'm not capable of making an in-depth political comment. So it'd be like above my state, above my political knowledge. It'd be above the Sun's level of political commentary. It was just a bit of an in-joke they were doing, but it was quite a good one. Well done, the Sun. But
when you talk about, you know, being above the Sun's level, always reminds me one of my favourite moments ever in Have I Got News For You, where there's something happened in the Channel Tunnel. And they said, here's the diagram shown in the Daily Telegraph. And it's this really complex diagram. It showed you all the different tunnels and where the escape routes were. And if there's a problem in one direction, how they get out the other way and this, that, and the other. And they said, and here's the Sun's diagram. And it was literally just a map of England, the south of England, the north of France, with a line drawn between the two countries. England, yeah. France, Channel Tunnel, labelled on the diagram.
There been an explosion under there, they would have done that sort of explosion image, wouldn't they, in the middle of it?
Probably. So, Crystal Palace are officially the most interesting club, A to C, in English football. Next week, we're going to be talking about Everton. So, no D's, sadly, no Derby or Doncaster.
I'm glad you said that, because we usually, before we record this, we sort of say who's next after this. We didn't do that tonight.
No, and I just genuinely... very quickly went onto Google.
So, did you? Yes. I genuinely would have struggled there.
No, I was running through my mind, D, who begins with D? And then I went to Google. Okay, no one, that's why. Okay, so Everton are going to be next week. So, Mr. Day, it's been a pleasure. I'm glad to anoint some new champions, a new lineal title holder. Thank you very much. And, let's speak next week.
Goodbye.